I'm James French.
Hi, I'm Ted Diamond.
And this is The Awareness Connection, a podcast where we talk about mind-body awareness, health, human development. And today we're going to be talking about a continuation of last podcast's topic. Last podcast, we talked about evolution, your views, Ted, on the process of evolution, on some of the necessary sort of reformulations we can make to, you know, perhaps standard evolutionary theory, you know, sort of large scale takes. We talked about the evolution of forms. Then we touched on education and we touched on consciousness, and these two being very related and very related to the idea of transformation. We said things like, you know, consciousness is perhaps the most transformative capacity. And we link that to education. This time we're going to continue on that to the topic of synergy. And correct me if I'm wrong, Ted, but this is a little bit of like nuts and bolts, your views of evolution. You know, this is like a, you know, sort of like a subtopic, like how does it actually work? Right? Would you say that's at least, you know, kind of like an accurate way to start?
Yeah, I think synergy captures the idea that evolution is creative in some way, brings elements together into a larger whole. It's always sort of fascinated me, and I think it's a critical aspect of evolution that we tend to discount.
Okay. Yeah, so how would you like to start the conversation in that case? I mean, you know, of course, it's linked with evolution, education, consciousness, like we said last week. But, you know, we're really going to delve into this particular topic this week, synergy.
Yeah. Well, I think a good starting point is human evolution, because as you know, James, I've had an interest in evolution. And when I began running a school years ago, and I began to look at anatomy and I began to teach anatomy, I was always struck by the fact that the human being, but not just the human being, other living forms exhibit elements of complexity that don't seem to be entirely explained by evolution.
Okay.
So, as you know, I don't discount evolution.
Yeah, it's important to say that, you know.
Yeah. I don't believe that there's a designer that created species immutably. Mm-hmm. I believe evolutionary theory is basically correct. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it tells the whole story, and that's sort of what I was always struck by. And in particular, the human being is so complex that it's hard to fathom how something so amazingly designed can come out of a process that's supposed to be simply tinkering and making small modifications as a random process of accommodation to the environment. That just doesn't add up.
You hear this a lot about, you know, I don't know if this is a view that's, you know, I'm not really sure the view that's held by, you know, people in the profession of like biological evolution. But, you know, you of course hear this a lot about how, you know, the human body is a set of compromises and poor compromises, you know, the knees and the shoulders and the, you know, we don't have great vision. You know, it's sort of like people are registering complaints. It's and there's sort of like like this. I don't know. It's a stance of like world weariness or something, like a stance of like cynicism that shows that people are like sophisticated. Oh, you know, the human body, you know, the back's terrible design and the knees are a terrible design, etc. you know, it seems to be kind of like a pervasive view.
Sure is, yeah. Well, that's a good one, the back.
Mm.
Because there's so much wrong with that view. So there's a key element, a key modification that happens in our common ancestor that leads to humans. So we share a common ancestor with, let's say, chimpanzees. And a chimpanzee is one branches off from our common ancestor and never became fully upright. They're not supposed to. They're not on some meaningful path. They're not in some purposive. They're just one among many different designs found in nature. Okay, I grant that. That's reasonable enough. Human beings are another branch. And there are a number of other upright forms, other types of humans, let's say, that went in a similar direction. And in all of them, you see the fact that this particular primate, we're a primate, went upright. Unlike a chimpanzee, we went fully upright. And for that to happen, you had to have a major modification in the spine. Presumably this had an advantage, so it was selected, or it was selectively advantageous in the environment of the human being at the time, where this spine, which is sort of largely curved this way, and like it is in four-footed animals, developed a lumbar curve here. So now the whole thing that's sort of toppling over this way could be fully upright.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the human spine. There's another curve here. There's four curves. And that conferred a big advantage because an animal that goes up on its hind legs now has the four legs are free to become manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
We know that that was a major change, not the brain. The brain size didn't precede that. The brain increase in size followed that.
After
you know that. That's pretty clear from evidence.
Yeah.
But what everyone says is, yeah, there was some advantage, but in order to get to that point, that lumbar curve, you know, was a flaw.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it's a flaw. Back pain is arguably the most common universal health problem in human life. Okay. The problem with that view, or the problem with that, as you say, cynical kind of statement that, yeah, we're a modification, but we made a lot of, you know, trade-offs and it's really kind of a unwieldy, gangly thing. The problem is that the human upright posture is by far and away the most complex architectural structure in the known universe. It's a thing of such marvelous complexity. It's a thing that's so amazing that to simply describe it as a modification of the common ancestor spine that we share with the chimpanzee is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Because number one, it's not just one thing that gets modified, but thousands of different things that are all morphing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And number two, it resulted in a form so complex that we put the common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees to shame in terms of what we're capable of doing.
Yeah.
So the question is, how does that happen? I mean, you could describe that as a simple modification, but it's hardly a modification. You already have, in any primate, you already have an incredibly complex living thing, which, as we saw last time, is built upon other layers of complexity, like the cell, which is in itself an amazing thing.
Yep.
And then you have the whole thing now, which is so complex, morphing into something even more complex. So it's more like a building that morphs into an incredibly beautiful cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cathedral morphs into something that has a telegraph system at the top, and it morphs into something entirely different. It's more like that.
Mm-hmm.
So evolution strikes me as being not just modifications of from earlier forms, but synergy or building complexity.
And so synergy, the word, you know, the choice of the word, meaning like, you know, maybe we can illuminate this a little more with like other examples. Something that that kind of made this a little clearer to me when you started talking to us about it and talking to me about it too, was the wing. You know, this is a form that we find in nature in various various times and places. You know, there are mammals with wings. There are the descendants of dinosaurs with wings, or birds. There are insects with wings. It seems to be like something that's been touched upon. That's a concept from evolution. What is it, like homologies, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So the way that you speak about the wing is similar to the way that you speak about upright posture. And I think it really illuminates the reason why you use this term synergy.
Yeah. Yeah, like how, yeah, because that's another one. How did the wing appear? It's like, you know, it's like all of a sudden it's as if you're working in a workshop and you're coming up with some simple design for producing locomotion, and all of a sudden you've come up with something that flies. I mean, it's like and then it didn't even quite happen that way. The theories about the evolution of a wing are a little controversial, but if an animal has some kind of a feathered animal that's using feathers for insulation, let's say, or thermoregulation, is in a tree and finds that it could use the wing, the feathers on its forelimbs for a little bit of guided flight, let's say, or jumping more effectively. Okay, that's kind of gangly and awkward, but it gives it some advantage and maybe can get away from a predator or something. But all of a sudden, that becomes an emergent capacity in evolution. And then you see it very quickly is adapted and becomes the incredibly efficient form of locomotion you see in birds,
yeah,
or bats, which are a mammal, but or insects. And there are, what, 60,000 flying insects or something.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just amazing. And then once you have that, then some little sort of very limited description of how it might have evolved is no longer adequate to describe flight, because it's so now you need engineers who are experts in the dynamics of airflow to explain how that works so efficiently. It's just an incredible thing. Mm-hmm. And evolution seems to produce thousands and thousands of these sort of amazing designs.
Yeah. Like there's, you can see how, you know, there could be many, many, many steps along the way. You know, you can see, you know, just like you said, maybe using it for a little bit of guidance, or maybe something can, you know, jump a little farther. You can see like a flying squirrel doesn't quite fly, but it has webbing here. You know, it's maybe 3 million years in the future, it's like descendants will be flying. I don't know. But the process that you describe is like almost like when you're writing and you don't quite know how to say something, you don't quite know, not only not how to say something, but you don't quite know what you're saying.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden there's clarity and you realize, oh, this is what I'm trying to say. And now I shape the form of the piece of writing around it. Like there's some clarity. And it seems very emergent and it seems very analogous. Like a wing sort of happens as a result of many, many iterations before it and many effective iterations probably, but a wing appears. And then it's the wing itself that's like elaborated on and transformed and changed.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And it's sort of like this like an invention. And that's and writing itself is an example of something that doesn't, you can't, evolution is always, the evolutionary people are always anxious to say that whatever we are is tied to some kind of random non-purposive event that preceded it. I mean, that's sort of a foundational idea in modern science. Mm-hmm. And I get that, you know, it wasn't planned. It's not going in a particular direction. It's not part of a progressive ladder. You know, we are just one among many animals, you know, no more or less evolved in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the ability to write is not predicted by the cognitive capacities that preceded it. You could say, well, writing is just a fancy version of using symbols, and using symbols is just a fancy version of communicating. That's just a fancy outcome of the fact that we are clever primates. But that doesn't explain writing. Mm-hmm. Writing is something that isn't just a fancy version of something preceded it. Writing is a whole new cognitive ability.
Yeah.
And so are other elements of consciousness. Yeah, you could say quieting the mind is just a disciplined use of attention to stop the chattering narrative of consciousness, so that now we are quiet because we've focused on the ability to be quiet. But that's not what happens when you quiet the mind. The mind begins to operate in insight. Where does that come from? It's as if you've uncovered something that was already behind it that allows it to operate at a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is not explained simply by random prior events. It's synergetic. And I think, in general, evolution as an expression of life is synergetic. And to my mind, it seems to me to in some way counterbalance the entropic forces where things break down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the theory of entropy, or a key principle in science, that things that are organized tend to devolve into something less organized. But life is, which we dismiss it as an anomaly, is a push toward order. And we seem to have a kind of a dualism between the two things, or a polarity between the two things. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be more closer to what's happening.
So could you talk about, like, why you choose this term synergy? You know, this is a fascinating term, I think.
Yeah.
You know, like the way that I understand the word synergy would be, you know, perhaps like in the interplay between several elements, you know, several perhaps distinct elements. There's not just sort of, there's not really just interplay or just play, just random interaction, but there's actually a new behavior that arises.
Yeah.
Like a conversation between two toddlers might just be each of them having their own conversation. But after a certain age, you have kind of like a meeting of the minds here, where they're playing off each other and they're really building something. That would be a synergy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm looking up the definition. Exactly. It's what you said, to elements combining to produce an effect greater than the sum of their separate effects. I like the word, because it seems to suggest something that counters entropy, counters breaking down. It's a building up.
Mm.
And it just seems important to me. I mean, it's so easy to look at, how, you know, you meant use the word cynicism. How cynical is the view that, that we weren't meant to produce art. We're just clever primates, but because we have the ability to hear sounds, I'm talking about music now, because we have the ability to hear sounds and we enjoy hearing them and we appreciate certain ones over other ones, now we can put them together in a creative way to make music. So now music is an accompaniment of our clever ability to distinguish between sounds. Yeah. Well, that's so limiting, because
What did you say, James? I know, it's like, you know, the view of somebody without any deep experience, music, like, it can evoke the deepest aspects of living. It can recall ancestry. You can evoke death. Talk about like intimations of the divine. It could evoke all of these things.
Yeah.
Shared experience between people as well, like from one mind to the other through sound. Like, oh my God, you know?
Right. Yeah. And the same scientists who make that claim about how limited it is themselves are pretty often express a deep appreciation for music. Mm-hmm. So their own, their view contradicts their own lived beliefs.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's sort of like the same people say, well, we don't really have free will. I don't really believe in free will. We're really just triggered by prior events and free will's an illusion. Well, but, you know, but I see them exerting free will every moment. I mean, the very fact that they're saying that there's no free will is an act of free will. And that, I would find that disturbing to have a belief that, to make a claim based on my scientific background that completely contradicts my lived beliefs. I would look at myself and wonder why I have such a contradiction. Mm-hmm. But I was going to say that if we're able to create music at this meaningful level, what does that mean? It's so easy to dismiss the music as not being meaningful. Well, it's just we enjoy it a lot. We just appreciate it. So we pass it back and forth and we call that music and musical enjoyment. But it diminishes the, like you said, it diminishes the purpose of life. It diminishes the development of faculties. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was thinking today we have our 10-year-old nephew visiting. Mm-hmm. And we love having him for a few days. And, you know, we go down the street and, just the way he walks down the street and stops and he's holding an umbrella. We went yesterday to get pizza. And he's holding an umbrella because it's raining. And then he gets under the canopy of, a scaffolding. And he immediately pulls the umbrella away because he knows he's protected from the rain. Mm-hmm. And then the moment he steps outside, he puts the umbrella back. And now he's playing with the umbrella. And the whole thing is an act of learning of such high order complexity. Mm-hmm. And what do? We say, come on, keep going. We're late, you know. And we diminish in the very act of, you know, training kids, we diminish the miracle that is a human intelligence. And I think the evolutionary theory contributes to that because of the cynicism it expresses.
Yeah.
And we it's so easy to dismiss something like music and say, you know, well, we don't know where it comes from. So it's just sort of an inspiration. People make meaning out of it and it doesn't really have any meaning, but it's such a, it's so lacking in appreciation
mm-hmm.
for what we actually are,
yeah.
you know? Yeah. So that's a big reason why I think the idea is important and why it's important to challenge the evolutionary kind of reductionist view of it.
Yeah. 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 Like a view that might not even really be shared by the greatest like theorists either, ironically. You know, the Darwins, the guys like Einstein didn't have like, you know, reductionist views. They had like highly philosophical views as well.
Yeah, he certainly did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And Darwin, I think, you know, Darwin would say, well, Darwin himself felt that he was trying to figure, he grappled with the idea that we were, he believed in God. He thought, not sure that the theory that God created these different species and put them on the earth immutable as immutable, unchangeable forms. He disputed that, he challenged it, and he amassed a lot of evidence to show that that was not true in his view.
Mm-hmm.
But he never gave up his sense of religious awe. And I appreciate that. But instead, the science say, yeah, but that's because he was still stuck on Christianity or something. Well, you could dismiss his view, or you could say, well, you like one part of his view, but I don't like the other part of his view. But he was actually, in a sense, more accurate than the people who rigidly subscribe to his theory, because all his theory does is show that a particular species, like a particular bird species of bird, was not immutably created, but came from earlier forms. It does not say what life is.
Yeah.
Darwin never claimed to know what life is. He said from some primordial source, you know, he left it an open question because he knew he didn't know. I mean, he didn't know and he knew he didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But we take the whole theory as if we kind of know the whole thing's been explained. And it's hardly been explained.
Right.
We don't even understand how a cell functions as a living form and the miracle of a single cell, let alone a human being.
Yeah.
So I like the humility in this theory, and I like the fact that there's a religious element of appreciation and inspired. And he was so inspired by living forms and what they meant in the natural world. I love that.
Yeah, it drove him. It drove him so much. This discussion of living forms, like your synergy view about the emergence of forms in evolutionary history, you know, the history of life on this planet. We spoke last week about causality and how you speak about, and you also write about, you know, recently you've written about the view of causation found in Aristotle, which is like a pretty complex view. And this is a view that was shared, or, you know, at least shared in its level of complexity by many theorists talking about causality, where it's not just sort of like from behind causality, where, you know, sort of being pushed along randomly, but causation forward, not necessarily there's a finished design that we're going for, but like when you speak about the wing, the emergence of a wing, you can imagine there's not necessarily a finished form that some designer is going toward, but I mean, a fully formed wing in whatever manner it arises, a fully formed wing gets invested in somehow, you know, the necessary components for a fully formed wing include something that can trap air, something that can create lift, something that has a lot of surface area, but not a lot of weight. All of these things have to go together and probably be elaborated on. And then you finally get something that's like, can truly be called a wing. And your claim is also that upright posture that we find in our primate lineage, this upright posture, is one of these forms, is one of these synergetic forms. And you go so far as to call it fully upright. You know, that's an important adjective, right? A fully upright posture.
Yeah.
And that it was kind of achieved.
Yeah.
You know, like you said before, it was achieved incidentally long before our large brain that we have in our own species, you know. But yeah, I think that your claim that the fully upright form is one of these examples of a synergetic form is really cool. It's really interesting. You know, it makes a lot more sense of the work that we do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And right. And it's so easy. It's easy. We're so used to seeing it, you know, someone walking on 2 feet, but when you study it and you look at what's involved in just the act of walking on 2 feet, it's such an amazing, incredible design.
Mm-hmm.
And not the most beautiful. I mean, I think of the bird in flight, particularly the big birds of prey. I mean, that's something beautiful to watch. It's something more elegant and, kind of aesthetically pleasing about it than the human walking form. But the ability of a human being to stand upright, and when the human upright form is working well and you see the lightness, and then you think about what's involved in walking, which is the whole body inclining forward, I mean, the entire from foot to head, and the legs swinging underneath to support as you move, or the ability to do that to run, to take that into a full run, or the ability to turn and the spiraling actions that happen, the ability, the counterbalancing movements of the arms with the legs and the freedom of the arms. It's just such an amazing architectural wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just, and we hardly appreciate it. And you hear people speak about it like it's some stupid thing. And it's hardly some stupid thing. I mean, it's just, it needs more study and more appreciation than we've given it, you know?
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking about while you were saying this, because it seems like the fully upright form at least for adult people, like many adult people who would otherwise be interested in other subjects to study them professionally. The fully upright human form requires study, because otherwise it's hidden. It like seems to be hidden. And this is the subject that you chose your career for. This is the, you know, the actual study of the upright function, the study of the upright human form. This is the thing, you know, we've spoken about this in earlier podcasts. This is the thing that we often see in very, very young children, the full function of the upright form. And then we see it's like deterioration later on, especially in adulthood. But like the beauty of the fully upright form and the amazing design of it, the amazing function of it, I think is hidden, which is one of the reasons why we don't appreciate it. Like, you know, it sort of allows this like cynicism based on our own injuries and, you know, our own like bad knees and stuff to creep in. And it distorts our view of the evolution of forms even.
Yeah. And then if you think about it, when we have some higher function, we tend to attribute it to something else. So you see in Plato, the idea, or you see it in Eastern philosophy, the idea that if there's something higher than the bodily form, which you think of as more lowly, then it's the soul, which maybe exists at a higher level. Or in Plato, you know, the ability to think of an idea partakes of some larger idea, and we are only able to we can perceive it in some way, but we're not the originator. So we tend to place the higher things outside and further diminish what we are, you know. And then also the upright posture. I mean, one of the things that always fascinated me in particular about human upright posture is the relationship of posture in humans to thought. So you see in a dog that's oriented horizontally so that it moves in the direction that it's oriented. It moves, it sees something, and it's designed to move in the direction of the thing it sees. That's all changed in a human being because we've gone upright. And if we see something, we still have to support ourselves upright to see. So there's a kind of a decoupling between perception and movement, where we kind of now move upwardly in some way in order to move forward to the thing we see. And the decoupling results in some kind of ability to think separately from action. So that in humans, you have this, it's almost expressed in our upright posture that we could just look around and we don't automatically move toward things. We just look, and you see it in young children that are just standing and looking around or wondering or able to consider possibilities in a new way. And I just think it's interesting that the upright form seems to be linked with the new possibilities of consciousness. I think that's so fascinating.
Yeah.
And it's pretty unique to humans.
Yeah.
And you see it, you kind of see it in other primates when they're sitting. Like you see the chimpanzee just sitting there, and then it could use a tool, like a primitive, you know, when they get the termites out of the mound. And you see them sitting, and they seem to be, it's one of the times when they seem to almost be able to think, and they have a sense of themselves that's quite palpable compared to, let's say, a dog, where you don't feel like a dog has a sense of self the way a chimpanzee does. But in human beings, it goes to a whole other level.
Yeah.
And I just find that intersection between the design and the conscious elements so fascinating.
Yeah.
We tend to diminish it and overlook how miraculous it is.
Right. Yeah. The you know, the ability to take in the environment, you know, to take in, you know, sensory data, to put it in that language, and to not act upon it, you know, or, you know, to not act upon it or to marvel at it, let alone, you know, this seems to go hand in hand with, like, at the very least, mammalian lineage, you know, because, you know, you've got a cat who can, you know, look at something that it wants to eat, but it's sort of always oriented toward getting at it somehow, you know. Yeah. It has this sort of postural thing that it does. It, you know, it's always oriented toward getting at it. But like you said, with this primate lineage, with this getting more on two feet, there seems to be like this separation, you know, you call it like a decoupling.
Yeah.
Where before, there was no separation, but now there are two things, kind of. That's a decoupling.
Hmm.
The environment and the internal discussion of it, or something like this. And then it's with fully upright human form. And again, this is an important formulation of yours, the fully upright human form. It seems to be like that there's something that opens up where there are even more decouplings that are possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Like a whole series of, yes.
A whole series of new decouplings.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we can now, if we're able to look independently of action, then we can see something, not for the purpose of doing something, but just to see it. And that's an amazing faculty. Some people say that some animals can do that a little bit, but not a lot. But we can just look at something as an act of just enjoying what we're looking at, and that's a sense of beauty. So you could see that aesthetic abilities and new cognitive abilities come into play. We can have an intention that's not linked with an immediate goal, but we can have an intention that'll be postponed for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I say, you know, I have something I want to do, but I'm going to wait. But I may wait years before I get to it. Like I've always wanted to have a house in the country when I retire. And when you retire, you remember this and you save money. You've spent 20 years just working toward that goal. I mean, how amazing that we can have a goal and never forget and not forget about it for two decades. I mean, all these things involve higher order cognitive abilities, higher order perceptual abilities, higher order behaviors, higher order relationship to the environment. You know, it's like we create worlds of our own.
Yeah. And like, talk about synergy, like the, you know, all of those examples that you just spoke about, even the one, you know, it's someone who wants to, you know, who wants to retire, in a certain way, like they rely upon capacities that we possess that need to be marshaled.
Mm.
They need to be marshaled and they need to be combined in certain ways. And of course, you know, the example you gave also depends on larger cultural issues, but like, you know, to talk about something more about the subject at hand, like if you want to say restore the natural function of your back muscles, like this requires patience, it requires intention, it requires working memory, it requires some time and, you know, the ability to manage your energies, and requires learning and enthusiasm all combined to make a goal occur.
Yeah, or any higher order skill. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you're not going to learn to play violin, you know, in a month. It takes years of combined skills and drive and conception and intention. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I mean, just to get back to consciousness, so conscious of all the abilities that seem to me to be emergent and amazing, the ability to become more conscious is the one that always drove me. That was the one I wanted to understand the most.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and in a way, synergy, the idea of synergy, underpins that idea. The fact that consciousness is an ability that we possess, but it's not simply a byproduct of evolution. It's a higher order potential that's contained in the human being as part of one of those hidden abilities. But and even that hidden ability is actually several abilities, a number of abilities. And I think that a full conception of education will include those abilities and not just the ones that we think of as more like playing an instrument or learning a subject. I think it will include those higher abilities as well.
All right.
And I think right now in our current state, we tend to think of those as esoteric or religious or otherworldly, but I don't think they are. I think they're part of what we actually are.
Yeah. Yeah. They, you know, like we said last week, like the issue of democratizing higher spiritual knowledge, if you want to call that, you know, it reformulates it into something that's part of an educational path. And it's really part of what we understand our potentials to be. And it's not necessarily for everybody, but of course, being a classical violinist is not for everybody, you know, but it's available and it's important. But it also enlarges the concept of education. It glorifies education. I don't know. There has to be a better word for that than glory. You mean
elevates in some way?
It elevates.
Really
elevates education. So it like democratizes spirituality in higher states, but it elevates education. This is something that we spoke about last week, and this really has a lot to do with, I don't know, like, understanding what you mean by synergy, understanding the evolution of forms. I mean, it's crazy that all these things are actually really related, and that they emerge from the study of the fully upright posture, and they emerge from the study of, say, vocal performance, something like this. It winds up opening up a whole view. I mean, it winds up opening up a whole rich field of which synergy is part, you know?
Yeah. And I wonder, James, I wonder if maybe I was just, when you mentioned this, I thought, well, I wasn't sure what our next topic is. We wanted to have Dr. Tara Fenimore come and speak about learning and education because she has focused on this aspect. Mm-hmm. Of what we do. And she's very busy, so I'm not sure we'll have her for next week. But maybe we could begin to speak about this part of it. Like what would, if some of these elements of consciousness are part of education and not simply glommed on, you know, like maybe asking kids to do yoga or something, which is not, to my mind, is not thoughtfully enough approach thoughtfully enough, because you can't just ask kids to do yoga, you know, at 4 years old. I mean, it's just not a well thought out process. If you're going to think through what some of these components are as part of educational development, what would that look like? What are some of those abilities? What would it look like? I think that'd be a great topic for our next podcast for that.
Yeah, certainly. You know, it feels like we've been wanting to talk about it because we've been touching on education
for
the past several podcasts, even though it seems like we're talking about evolution. You know?
Right. Yeah, maybe to bring it to show the practical side as it applies to kids. And I think that'd be interesting. Shall we do that next time? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's something really to look forward to. So.
Great.
Yeah. The past couple of weeks we've been talking about evolution, and we always kind of wind up wanting to talk about education and learning. And so next time we're going to talk about education and learning and what this looks like on a practical level. You have a lot of experience.
Great.
So thank you for the conversation. Thank you everybody for listening. Remember to like and subscribe on YouTube and find us on your favorite platform, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.